It's The Real News. I'm Aaron Maté, continuing with Tim Shorrock, correspondent for The Nation, whose blog, Dispatch Korea, is at timshorrock.com. And we're talking about President Trump's cancellation of his June 12th summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Now Trump says the two sides are talking again and the meeting could be back on. So, Tim, I want to play for you a clip of Senator Lindsey Graham. He was speaking today on the Today Show. And he said that the cancellation of the summit, which of course he blamed on North Korea, makes war far more likely.
Senator, the foreign minister of North Korea last week said, we're not giving up our nuclear program. Denuclearization is off the table, is what he said, which is the entire objective, I imagine, from where you're sitting and from where the president's sitting. So if that's true and they won't agree to give up their nukes, where does that leave you? What's the objective now?
Military objective.
Is that where we are now?
That's where we're headed. If that statement holds true, and I don't believe it, I believe they believe that Trump will use military force. For 30 years, they have played us. They understand our election cycle. They're trying to run out the clock. They understand that 2019 is the year before a presidential election. They think Trump's just like everybody else. He's not.
That's Senator Lindsey Graham speaking on the Today Show on Friday. So, Tim, Graham is saying there also that that because he says North Korea has been playing the U.S. for 30 years, and if they are insisting that they will not fully denuclearize, in his characterization, that that's actually what makes war more likely. If you could respond to what he said there.
First of all, the question itself to Graham was wrong. They did not say they would not negotiate about their nuclear weapons. They said they would not surrender their nuclear weapons, you know, without some kind of negotiation and discussion about broader issues and dealing with the American hostile policy, which is what they're concerned about. So the question in itself was wrong. But, you know, Senator Lindsey Graham is like the biggest warmonger out there. He just loves the idea of a war with Korea, and that's what he really wants, I think. And he's always talking about this. I mean, but, you know, what was really interesting was, what's interesting about Senator Graham is that, I mean, he's really detested in South Korea because of the things he said. This man has just no credibility at all, and you know, I've talked to people in South Korea who tell me that, you know, his name is now mud there because that he's seen as a very, very dangerous man, which I agree that he is. So I don't really, you know, think that anything he says, you know, has much to do with reality at all. He would just love to see a war.
You know, Tim, what you pointed out there is really important because it speaks to the power of Western propaganda and how misconceptions and the dominant Western narratives about North Korea can then shape how journalists cover it. And I didn't know what you pointed out, which is that the characterization of what the North Korean minister said about denuclearization was wrong because what the reality that you pointed out totally undermines the premise of the question. It speaks to how powerful the dominant sort of hawkish narratives are. You mentioned, though, the people of South Korea. So let me ask you, what do you think the reaction is there right now? Certainly hopes have been really high for the summit taking place. And talk about the mobilization around peace, promoting a reconciliation with the North that's been happening in South Korea.
Well, you know, ever since this process began and as it deepened, the support for Moon Jae-in and the support for the peace process within South Korea has been very high, very strong. And, you know, Moon's popularity is around 85% now, which is kind of unbelievable for any leader on the world stage. And, you know, the percentage of people who actually, you know, want to engage with North Korea and trust North Korea has gone way up, too. So there was a recent poll of about something like 65% said they believed and had faith in what Kim Jong-un had said when he, you know, visited the South in the summit on April 27th, briefly visited the South on April 27th. And so, you know, the hopes are very high that this time it can work out. And I think that they want to proceed no matter what the United States does, you know, people in Korea. Because they've been having this fear of war and conflict for long enough, and they want to move forward on ending the war. So, you know, and as you know, Women Cross DMZ and the Nobel Women's Initiative, which have been organizing, working with women, you know, peacemakers around the world, they are there in Korea right now, in Seoul right now. They actually wanted to go to North Korea, but the U.S. Would not give travel visas to any Americans going there. But they're there, and they've been meeting with, they had a good meeting with the U.S. Embassy, and they had a demonstration at the U.S. Embassy last night. And many Korean groups were also there, you know, demonstrating. And so I think there's this very strong feeling in South Korea now that they've, you know, reached a point where, you know, they're almost there. They're on the verge of a very strong agreement and something that could be a breakthrough and really, really ease the tensions and get back to a place when the two sides are engaging again in all kinds of ways. And then, you know, suddenly Trump and this tantrum he throws, you know, closes the door on them. People were really disappointed to hear, really angry to hear that the summit had been canceled, except for this very small minority of about, you know, 20%, 18 to 20% that, you know, wants Trump to bomb North Korea and wants a war. People that think like Lindsey Graham. And that's a very small minority, though. And so, you know, you have these, like, they're the people that love the idea, the talk of war. But, you know, I think the people in South Korea, and, you know, let's remember that, you know, Moon Jae-in came to power on the wave of this, you know, candlelight revolution against, you know, a president they saw as dictatorial and corrupt, and was also very militaristic in her approach to North Korea. And the candlelight revolution, you know, led to her impeachment. And that's how Moon Jae-in won. So he's got the people. I mean, the people are really strongly behind this. And I think it's kind of ironic to see even, you know, so many American critics, both from the conservative side, neocons and liberals, who are against, you know, talking with Kim Jong-un and against this kind of, you know, direct engagement. They're siding with this very small right-wing, very extreme right-wing minority in South Korea.
You know, Tim, speaking of the neocon liberal consensus when it comes to North Korea and the U.S., let me put you to two narratives that I've seen to explain the cancellation of this summit, not blaming Trump and the gang around him, but saying two things. One is that Kim Jong-un played Donald Trump, that this was his plan all along. And two, this was curious to me. There was a big piece on NBCNews.com by Andrea Mitchell called "The North Korea Summit Crumbled After China Lined Up Against It." And it quotes Western officials or Western experts, quote unquote, and Western officials, current and former, basically saying that China fears a unified Korea. It doesn't want to see a capitalist democracy so close to it. And it played a major role in canceling the summit, also because it felt like it was on the sidelines.
Well, I don't think China had anything to do with the cancellation at all. I mean, these issues that I spoke about before involving, you know, the Libya option, Bolton, Pence, and then military exercises were there before Kim Jong-un went to China the second time. And, you know, that, in fact, on some issues, like on the issue of troop withdrawal, U.S. troop withdrawal from South Korea, for example, the Chinese have a stronger position on this than the North Koreans do. The North Koreans have told the U.S. Not only in this round of negotiations, but also in past negotiations, that they might be able to live with presence of American forces in South Korea after a peace agreement. And, you know, when you talk privately with Koreans who are knowledgeable about that, they say that, you know, in some ways, the North Koreans see the potential for U.S. forces to be a kind of check on China's power in Asia itself. I mean, you have to understand that North Korea's relations with China are not great. And North Korea's always resisted attempts by China to, you know, run its affairs or intervene in its affairs and sort of, you know, control the whole way it deals with the United States. And China and North Korea has resisted that. So, you know, it was natural that the Chinese would invite Kim there. He went there twice. And, at, you know, his first trip, that was the first time he'd ever met the Chinese leadership. So, you know, he's had very poor relations with them for, you know, years since he really came to power. And, in fact, kind of eliminated a faction within the Workers' Party in North Korea that was closely allied with China and that were making all the money from the trade with China. So, you know, I mean, it's like I said, it's you know, it's of course they're going to meet with him and they want to be on the same page when it comes to negotiation on peace. And China can play an important role in helping to guarantee the peace. And they would have to sign any kind of peace agreement because they're one of the signatories of the armistice in 1953, along with the United States and North Korea. So they have that role to play. But to say that they're the ones that influence you know, this cancellation, I think is ridiculous. And you know, NBC is just, they're just following that line, because so many of the national security people here in Washington, the whole focus, of course, is on China and the rise of China and fears of China, military power, and so on. But they don't carefully analyze, and they don't really know anything about China's, you know, actual relationship with North Korea, which has been very rocky at times.
Right. And if China is a major reason why the U.S. has, you know, over 27,000 U.S. troops there with an eye on China, then that would make it understandable then why hawkish militarists in Washington would be upset at the prospect of possibly those forces being withdrawn under a potential U.S.-North Korea deal. But finally, Tim, let me ask you. So you have a plane ticket to go to Singapore to cover the planned summit that was canceled. So are you keeping your reservation?
Right now I'm keeping it. I mean, yesterday I almost canceled it, but then, you know, I figured, well, things might change, you know. And actually, within an hour, he was, you know, back. He was backing up from what he said earlier yesterday. So yes, I'm keeping my ticket. I'm keeping my hotel reservations. I got all my information at the White House travel office. And if it happens, I'll go. And, you know, maybe it won't happen on June 12th, but I have a feeling that this summit is going to happen because, you know, the statement that the North Koreans put out yesterday, this Deputy Minister Kim, was actually, you know, they actually had kind of kind words for Trump even after he'd canceled it. And, you know, he stuck up for the woman, Chae Sun-hee, who had written this bitter, you know, blistering polemic that set Trump off. He, you know, backed her up. But they also said, you know, they're willing to talk, and they're willing to talk to the U.S. anytime. So, you know, if anything, you know, North Korea is coming out of this, you know, looking pretty level-headed and looking, you know, kind of moderate in terms of their negotiating strategy, where Trump looks completely incompetent.
Not for the first time. Well, we'll leave it there.
Not
Tim
for
Shore,
the first time.
Correspondent for The Nation, his blog, Dispatch Korea, is available at timshorrock.com. Tim, thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us on The Real News.
Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So that was Tim Shorrock on The Real News talking about the situation in Korea. And The Real News, The Real News. Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
Hi, everybody, this is Lee Fields. You're listening to CFRU. You heard me, CFRU.
Teens from Spain and France will be paying their annual visit to our region this summer. They will be studying English and enjoying a month of fun and sightseeing. CanadaLink English is looking for families with an extra bedroom and some spare time to host these young people in their homes for 1 month. Programs are being run in Guelph, as well as Waterloo, Cambridge, Brantford, and Fergus Alora. While in Guelph, the teens will attend English language classes every weekday morning at the University of Guelph. In the afternoon, they participate in cultural and sports activities. The program is organized so that working families who are away during the day can qualify as hosts. Families interested in learning more can contact Margaret Burnett at 519-821-1247 or by email at margaret@canadalink.com. A per-week honorarium is paid to each host family to cover expenses. For more info, including info on the programs in other cities, visit canadalink.com. That's CanadaLINC.com.
Hello, my name is Arun. I host Navrang Wealth every Saturday, 11 a.m. to 12 noon on CFRU 93.3 FM. Each week, we bring Bollywood music in Hindi and Punjabi, South Asian masala and gup shop, and much more. So keep listening Navrang Wealth every Saturday.
I love my India. I love my India.
Are you feeling sad?
Feeling today? Are you okay?
What's your zone?
Red,
yellow,
blue,
or green?
Paisley Roads Grade 4s are here to help.
Hey, have you ever experienced going to the store and the thing you want is not there?
That might put you in the yellow zone. That is when you are stressed or close to mad.
Here are some ways to calm down and get back to the green zone.
First, take 3 deep breaths to calm down.
Or ask an employee if they have any in stock in the back of the store.
Or
go to another store to buy what you want.
Now you know your zones. Ta-da!
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU. So I want to close out the show with Michael Parenti's talk called Rambo and the Swarthy Hordes. And, of course, you heard a clip from that particular talk right at the beginning of the program when he talked about the paradigm of the wagon train versus the Swarthy Hordes. And I talked about that in the context of Gaza and how that really, frames, like what really happened there. And you have, basically, these Israeli snipers, mowing down Palestinians who they don't see as human beings. They see the Palestinians as subhuman, and they're perfectly free to kill them. And this is the kind of thing that that you get. And this is a very common cultural trope, I would say. I would call it a cultural paradigm inside settler colonial societies. And, where basically you have the quote superior people. You have the human beings, the white settlers in the Wild West, or you have American soldiers in Vietnam, or you have, because obviously they can have kind of an imperialist kind of context too. Or even now, with zombie apocalypse flicks and stuff like that, where you have the chosen people, the survivors who are have to fight against these crazed savage beings trying to kill them and mowing them down or chopping them apart with axes or whatever. This is the kind of paradigm that you have, and they're fighting for survival, and they're under siege and this sort of thing, and it's the human beings under siege by subhumans. This is a very long-standing trope in Western culture, inside Hollywood and what have you. And this is the kind of thing you see in Palestine. This is how, Israelis, overwhelming, majorities of Israelis actually view the Palestinians. They view them as subhumans, and they see them, it's all right, this is a perfectly okay response to gun them down with sniper rifles. This is the kind of, the incredibly racist, the incredibly racist view, paradigm that is created by imperialism and created by settler colonialism. Whether it happens to be in North America or wherever else in the world, or Palestine, and this is what Michael Parenti unpacks in this talk, where he dissects the entertainment media and looks at these kind of images and how they manifest themselves in the these racist images, these imperialist images, how they manifest themselves in the media. So that's what this is about. So I'm going to play this right now. This is Michael Parenti with his talk, Rambo and the Swarthy Hordes. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
It's The Real News. I'm Aaron Maté. Continuing with...
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse. The talk we're about to hear by Dr. Michael Parenti is titled Rambo and the Swarthy Hordes. Michael Parenti is an author and political analyst. Among his books are The Sword and the Dollar, Inventing Reality, History is Mystery, and his latest, The Terrorism Trap. This talk was given in 1989 in North Hollywood, California, during the administration of George Bush I, an administration consisting of most of the same players that occupy positions in the present Bush administration. In the talk, Parenti looks at the entertainment media as a propaganda vehicle for American ruling class interests and attitudes. With the recent spate of war movies and TV shows glorifying the CIA, FBI, and police, this 13-year-old talk is eerily relevant. Control of media is even more concentrated now than 13 years ago, as most major media outlets are subsidiaries of massive corporations with interests in a variety of areas, including armaments. At the time this talk was given, Saddam Hussein was a great friend of the United States, and Osama bin Laden was, in the words of the great communicator Ronald Reagan, the moral equivalent of America's founding fathers.
I want to today give attention to the other side of the media, not the news media, but the entertainment media, because the entertainment media consumes a much larger share of the viewing time of most Americans than do the news programs. And I thought I would call this book something like The Hidden Political Images of the Entertainment Media. And then as I thought about it, I said, well, what's so hidden about it? It's rather blatant. And what I looked at are Hollywood films. That's what I'm studying, Hollywood films and TV dramas, TV miniseries, teleplays, and the like. What I find is a real abundance of images and ideologies, ones that are essentially supportive of imperialism, anti-communism, capitalism, racism, sexism, militarism, say militarism twice, militarism, authoritarian violence, vigilantism, and anti-working class attitudes. More specifically, I found these kinds of themes. Individual heroics predominate over collective action. There's almost no collective action. There's almost no story or drama where the people organize together and do something for themselves. I mean, there are one or two exceptions. When they do, when there is collective action, they're usually led by some hero who has to spur them on and really do the whole thing himself. Free enterprise is the best economic system in the world. That's a message which is not necessarily telegraphed so much as it is presumed. Certainly, there's nothing positive ever uttered about alternative systems in the entertainment media. Private monetary gain is a central and worthy objective of life. Although those who are too wickedly greedy, the Dynasty guys and Dallas fellows, they can meet with disapproval. Sometimes business characters are insensitive to other people's needs because they're so busy with their business activities, but when properly apprised of the problems and such, they are suddenly capable of legendary acts of generosity, which I've never seen in real life, but I see on television dramas say, the kid needs the house, give it to him. I'll give the factory to Joe, he's a good guy, and all that sort of thing. Workers are beer guzzling, regular Joes, I mean, good natured and all that, but really not very bright, incapable. If I was to say any one consistent stereotype I've seen about how blue collar people are portrayed in the media, with the exception of certain films, by the way, everything I say, there are a few notable exceptions, with the exception of a film like Silkwood or A Matter of Sex, a few others, they're almost always incapable of leadership and of acting as agents of their own lives. One wonders really where labor unions came from. Labor unions are always up to not much good. They're rather insensitive to the needs of workers. Some years back, there was a TV program, Archie Bunker, All in the Family, which was supposedly against various forms of bigotry. And while it came out against the bigot, who was Archie Bunker, and made a little message statement against bigotry, every program practiced a bigotry of its own by portraying the working person as this goof and goon, and one of the big laugh lines in All in the Family was when Archie Bunker mispronounced a word. committed a malapropism, and the canned laughter would come on. That's not funny. There's nothing funny when somebody mispronounces a word. I mean, all you're saying is that he hasn't had the opportunity to have the education that some other people have had. But class bigotry is a very common form of bigotry, and it remains totally unchallenged, unlike gender bigotry or race bigotry, which at least is challenged today. The practices and forms of class bigotry go on in abundance in the media and remain unchallenged. Affluent professionals in almost all programs are considered much more interesting than blue-collar or ordinary service workers. There are many more of them as principal characters. Women and ethnic minorities are really not as capable, effective, or interesting as white males. Cop shows, the police and everyone else should be given a freer hand in combating the large criminal element in America, using generous applications of force and violence without too much attention to constitutional rights. In fact, in any number of cop shows, the cop will get up and talk about that Constitution isn't going to protect you, it's only me with my gun, and the hell with the Constitution. The ills of society are caused by individual malfactors and not by anything in the socioeconomic system. No, no, no. There are some unworthy persons in our established institutions, but they are eventually dealt with and set straight for the most part. U.S. military force is directed only toward laudable goals, or more often the goals are not even stated. It's just assumed that we've got to win this one. Nothing said about what kind of interests are involved. I mean, after all, why are people doing all this fighting and killing? It's a question that remains largely unstated. Western industrial and military might, especially the U.S.'s, has been a civilizing force for the benefit of backward peoples throughout the Third World. The United States and the entire Western world have long been threatened from abroad by foreign aggressors, such as the Russians, communist terrorists, Arab terrorists, and generally the swarthy hordes of less developed peoples. Those are, I would say, some of the general themes that come up again and again in any number of movies. And the last one is the one I want to focus on today. It's the paradigm of the wagon train versus the swarthy hordes. First enunciated very well by in a marvelous article by Tom Engelhardt in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It could be happening in the American Wild West. It could be in the Amazon jungle, the North African desert, the Sudan, the Transvaal, the South Pacific jungles, or Indochina. The scene is generally the same. There's a fort, or an encampment, or a wagon train. And inside that encampment are the human beings. They're white. They're human. They're warm, they're attractive, they talk, and they're nice. Outside come the swarthy hordes, the savages. They can be Indians, they could be Bushmen, they can be Arabs on camels and horses or whatever else. And they are the subhumans, and they are attacking the human beings. And the wagons form their circle, and the human beings know what to do. They level their guns and they begin to knock off, shoot, and kill these screaming savages who attack them. Why do the swarthy hordes attack the white people? You don't know. They never tell you. Is it to protect their lands? Is it to protect their herds? Is it to protect their villages and their towns and their families and their children? No, it's just because they like to do that. That's their thing. They like to attack. And so they have to be killed. And by the way, it's not even bravery that they manifest as they charge in great numbers and get cut down in horrible numbers. This is not even bravery, although similar acts by whites would be portrayed as heroic. This itself is portrayed as a manifestation of the swarthy hordes, their fanatic, crazed way of wanting to bloodlust. Now, the trouble with this paradigm is that it turns the history of the last 400 years on its head. That it reverses the roles of usurper and usurped. It reverses the roles of victim and victimizer. It reverses the roles of those who were massacred and those who were doing the massacring. It was the European and North American civilizers, so-called, who went in there and destroyed the villages and destroyed their industries and destroyed their townships. Read Engels on North Africa, what happened to the Arabs and Berbers, and when he goes in and describes the beautiful towns with the fine, hard stone and plaster buildings and their woolen industries and their mining industries and their arts and crafts and all that. And then read the description of the French troops coming in and systematically destroying it and killing every man, woman, and child. Read about how the Germans went into South Africa and killed the Herero tribe. 80,000 people, they killed 60,000 of them, and the other 20,000 they used as slave labor in their mines. Read Mark Twain's angry, raging comments about King Leopold of Belgium, calling him a mad dog and what he did to the innocent, unoffending people of the Congo, taking them and enslaving them, a million of them a year dying in the mines in the Congo. That's what the history's about. That's what John Wayne is about. And what these films do is they reverse that history, stand it on its head. They do what Joseph Goebbels said. They give you a big lie and they embellish it and they make you root for the guys in the wagon train. Now, once you kill and once you plunder like that, once you go in to take another people's land and steal their labor and enslave their labor and take their resources and preempt and take over their markets, once you do that kind of act, and it wasn't we, it wasn't the ordinary people of Europe and North America that did it, it was the ruling interest that did it, and they used our taxes, our money, and our sons to go fight. But once you do that, you have to do two other things ideologically and psychologically. One, you have to deny the humanity of your victims. They are subhumans and they are moral inferiors. As John Wayne said in one of his horse operas in 1953, he said, "There's humans and then there's Comanches." A very clear message. He couldn't have said it better. There's humans and then there's Comanches. You're not killing human beings. You're killing these wild animals. By the way, you get the same quotes from Winston Churchill about the Afghanis. You can get the same quotes from George Washington about American Indians. And you can get them from any number of imperialists. The second thing you do is you must ascribe all your crimes to them. You deny your own inhumanity and you accuse your victims of doing to you what you have been doing to them all along. Sometimes imperialism can take on an endearing, tender note, though. I found one movie which I want to share with you. It was with little, cutesy, adorable Shirley Temple. She was in the movie called, ready for this, Wee Willie Winkie, 1937. And she asked her grandfather, who's the British colonel. They're off their way out in some place where the British have no business being. And she says, "Why are you mad at Khoda Khan, leader of the, quote, warlike tribes?" The British colonel answers tenderly, "Oh, darling, we're not mad at Khoda Khan. England wants to be friends with all her peoples. But if we don't shoot him, he'll shoot us." This is sort of the Pat Buchanan, Cap Weinberger approach to foreign policy. Now, another interesting thing, these defamatory stereotypes and images demonstrate the unholy marriage between imperialism and racism. Marx has a very fascinating quote, I've got it in The Sword and the Dollar, of British officers in the Sepoy Rebellion in India. It was a contemporary account. The officers said, "We hanged every nigger we found." In India, they're talking about India, use the term nigger. "We hanged every nigger we found." I mean, every Indian they came across, they hanged them. The suppression was horrible. In South Africa, the people are called Kaffirs. In the Middle East, ragheads. In Asia, slopes and gooks. Well, these terms, nigger, Kaffir, slopes, gooks, this is a vocabulary of imperialism as well as a vocabulary of racism. And indeed, I'm not going to argue that imperialism is the cause of racism, but certainly imperialism is one of the biggest instigators and propagators of it. You have to finally define whole categories of people as different and inferior to justify what you're doing. Even when the imperialism is not of the violent sort, and even when the racism is not evident, it still can permeate a film sort of implicitly. Take the case of how Hollywood has dealt with Africa. The Tarzan movies, I won't even say a word. There, it's so evident and so obvious. We'll just say the Tarzan movies. Okay, I've proven my case. But let's go on. Let's go on beyond Tarzan, and let's take a more modern-day effort. Finally. Finally. Hollywood. Finally, in the 1980s, in the last 30 years, I've been waiting for an intelligent movie about Africa. There's 1,000 stories in Africa. There are stories of tribal conflicts, of generational conflicts, of urbanization, of cultural change, of labor struggle, horrendous, incredible level of labor struggle like nothing you see in North America, like nothing you see in Europe. 250,000 gold miners out on strike together, and they don't have computers and carpools and all that sort of thing. Incredible amount of discipline and organization and courage from a people who supposedly are not ready for self-government. 1,000 stories, 1,000 dramas that you can make. And so Hollywood finally makes a movie about Africa, and it's called Out of Africa. And what's it about? It's about an upper crust Danish literati whose major concern, it seems, is to hang on to her plantation and get it together with her beautiful blonde boyfriend, Robert Redford. That's what the story was about, played by Meryl Streep. And the Africans in Out of Africa, I kept looking for the Africans. And there they were, sort of around the edges, saying things like, "Is Sahib happy? Does Sahib want dinner now? May I do this for Sahib?" Addressing her reverently. And then Robert Redford comes along and he sets her straight, because he's kind of gone native a little, you know, and he says, "I want to show you my Africa, the real Africa." I said, "Hey, here it comes, the breakthrough." And what does he do? He takes her up in the plane, and you see those same old aerial shots straight out of the Tarzan flicks of the zebra herds and the giraffes running along. Still no Africans. And I said, "Ah, this is why they named it Out of Africa, because there's nothing in Africa about it." Then finally we got to a really good film, and I do mean it, Gandhi, which at least portrayed Indian principles and showed the Indians acting with courage together, although it all came from the magic leadership of Mohandas Gandhi, apparently. And it even showed some of the brutality of the British. But even that film, I would have to make a serious criticism, because it gets to the heart of the political economy of the entertainment media. And that is that the political economy of imperialism was never shown in that otherwise fine film. The forced underdevelopment and impoverishment of India by British capitalism was never shown. The fact that when the British went into India between 1830 and 1900, the per capita earnings of the Indians dropped by 2/3. That India was pillaged. That poverty was not an original condition of India. India is a lush, fertile subcontinent. The poverty of India is a direct cause of the policies of British imperialism, which was to forcibly deindustrialize India. That could have been dealt with in some way. You know, you could say, well, you know, I mean, what do you want, Parenti? How can you do that in a film? I mean, you can't start reading tracts of Lenin in the middle of a film, or chapter 3 from The Sword and the Dollar. You know, you just can't do that. But during the course of a movie, you can have some discussion, some word explaining what are the British doing in India. I sat for 3.5 hours through that film, and they never explained why are the British in India? What are they doing there? And you're left with the impression that they're in India simply because they like to strut about with their swagger sticks, and they simply don't have the decency to go home when asked to go home. But in fact, very powerful British interests got very rich off the land, the labor, the resources, and the markets of India. A film that really deals in an uncompromising way, and in a very good way, it's not a particularly well-made film, but the script and the political content of it is terrific, was made in 1969. It deals with imperialism, the political economy of imperialism, too, and that was called Burn, an Italian-French production. It's nice to hear applause from the 7 people who were able to see that movie, because the distribution of that movie was remarkable. I mean, it actually dealt with the class interest behind it, dealt with the transition from slavery to free labor. You had Marlon Brando explaining why it'd be better, it would have less costs and all that sort of thing. This movie was suppressed in its distribution. It was taken out of circulation. It did not reach many theaters, and it did not stay long in the ones it did reach. And it would make a nice little story as to what happened to the distribution of that movie. There's another area where the wagon train paradigm exists, and that's right in the urban frontier. It's what Hal Himmelstein in his book on television calls the urban frontier. It's the fort, the wagon train, the encampment all over again, but it's in the middle of the city. Again, you've got the human beings, and they are under siege, and they are under siege again from swarthy hordes. There are plenty of TV shows, as you know, and plenty of movies. Let me just give you one called Cobra by Sylvester Stallone, who wrote it and acted in it. The comedian Jay Leno was right. Stars like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone deserve a lot of credit for opening up the acting profession to a lot of people who could not get into it back when speech was a requirement. Cobra is, and by the way, this has been a standard character over the last 20 years, in the last 15 years or so, in films and TV series. He's a whacked out Vietnam vet. Bitter, wounded, angry that he couldn't win it. He wanted to win it, and you didn't let him win it. So now he's a detective in New York, and he fights the whole gang, and they are trying to terrorize and take over the city, or the country, or the world. It's not clear. And so it's cowboy versus Indians, cowboy singular, cowboy versus Indians. And Cobra goes out there, and again, the same thing, makes his talks about you pussyfooting with the Constitution and all these rights, and I'm going to do it my way, and I'll really take care of them. And Cobra doesn't believe in sissy things like arrest, trial, and incarceration. He just executes these guys. He just murders people, and one of the gang guys he captures, he douses him with gasoline, and then he lights a match. As he sets fire to the guy, he sneeringly says, "You have the right to remain silent." Now, the most durable version of the swarthy hordes, that external alien menace that's going to come at us, is the red tide and the red menace. You can defeat the Indians and the Bushmen, but communism is still around there, and it will subvert us from within, or it will inundate us from without. You remember Ronald Reagan's speech about Nicaragua? If we don't stop them in Nicaragua, the red tide will be lapping at our borders. That Nicaragua is only 12 hours drive from Brownsville, Texas. That's if you drive 180 miles an hour, but whatever. Well, that basic paradigm, that image, is being propagated by our presidents, our political leaders. And in the 1980s, the Reaganite cinema reached new heights of anti-communism, and Soviet bashing reached new depths, I should say. Rambo 2 with Sylvester Stallone. In Rambo 2, Stallone, he not only acts, if you want to call it that, acts in these roles, he also writes the scripts. And he turns around in that movie and he says to his old Green Beret commander, he says, "Are we going to fight to win it this time?" And he certainly does win it. He goes into Vietnam and he kills a battalion of Russians. He kills the whole Vietnamese army. They throw napalm at him. He's captured by them. He's tortured. And he liberates prisoners of war. He's aided by the fact that his adversaries all seem to be legally blind. They cannot shoot straight. Hundreds of rounds are shot at him and they just always miss. Never fluff his hair. But while the movie is outrageous and it's ridiculous, again, don't lose sight of the fact that it's once more turning history on its head. I mean, in reality, the Vietnamese have exchanged prisoners of war with the United States after signing the Paris Peace Agreement, which ended the war. And that whole POW-MIA issue is really an outrageous pandering exploitation of the unrealistic hopes of those families conducted by the Pentagon and the U.S. government and played upon by people like Ronald Reagan. You know, there are 18,000 Americans missing in action from World War II. Where do you suppose they are? Are they being held captive in Toyota factories or in beer cellars in Wiesbaden someplace or something? No, tragically, unfortunately, sadly, they're dead, and it's acknowledged that they're dead. But the 2,000-some missing from Vietnam have never been acknowledged realistically for what they are, which is that they're dead. Instead, that issue is exploited. It's not only exploited, but whole movies are made out of it. Not just Rambo 2, but Missing in Action 1, Missing in Action 2, Missing in Action 3, Bradford Missing in Action 4, I think, is coming up soon. Second, U.S. prisoners of war were not tortured by the Soviets in Vietnam, as depicted in this film. They have Rambo being tortured by Russians. There is no historical record of that. There is, however, record of South Vietnamese-trained forces and U.S. special forces using all sorts of torture, electric shock, water treatment tortures on National Liberation Force fighters. Third, the Soviets did not drop napalm on anyone in Vietnam. You know who dropped the napalm in Vietnam. Just complete turning around. The U.S. dropped huge amounts of napalm and Agent Orange, something like 20% of the land. The whole food chain in Vietnam has been tainted. Vietnam was a country that had no liver cancer. It was an unknown disease because people ate sensible food like rice and grains and vegetables. And today it has one of the highest rates of liver cancer in the world because of what we did to their ecology chain. That's not what you get in the film. I guess you can get that kind of lying from somebody like Sylvester Stallone. If he could portray himself as a fearless war hero, even though he spent the Vietnam era working at a private girls' school in Europe, why would we expect him to play straight with the larger history, right? Rambo 3, Rambo is in Afghanistan now. And the Soviets are portrayed as sadists, rapists, and torturers who murder little children with explosive toys, a horror story that originated, propagated by the CIA, for which there's no evidence. The Red Army has got better things to do than put toys down to blow up kids' fingers. For fun, good old Rambo sends a Soviet captive plummeting. He takes him, puts a noose around his neck, and he throws him off a cave shaft down to his death. And then for still more fun, Rambo dynamites him. Blows him up. He had him rigged up and he sets him off. What a guy, that Rambo. He gets along real swell with the Mujahideen killers, the feudal landowners, the Islamic fanatics, and the opium growers, the guys who took up guns when the Kabul government said that their women could take the veils off and the women could go to school and their children could go to school. They took up guns, laughably described as the Afghan freedom fighters. Those of you who supported them, I hope you continue to support and watch how they operate and what they stand for. Let me say that Rambo gets along real well with them. By the end of this third and worst of the Rambo films, our hero has sort of mellowed out a little. He gives his good luck charm to an adoring 12-year-old Afghan boy soldier who himself is shown killing Russians on several occasions. War is a kind of a healing, nurturing experience for Rambo. You know, in Rambo 1, which I didn't mention, he was a borderline psychotic. He got into all sorts of trouble. He was a Vietnam veteran who was just psyched and freaked out. By the end of Rambo 3, all this violence has kind of put him together. He's found himself. As the movie ends, you feel he's going to move on, maybe head back to the States, buy a trailer, hunt bear, settle down maybe, you know, get married, open up the nicest little gun shop in Texas. Get married, I don't know about get married, because women don't figure in the Rambo movies. In fact, most of these violence adventure movies, women just really literally don't figure, of course, as except for the bed scene or sex objects. They are just attachments, accessories to the heroes. I mean, literally attachments. They're usually attached, being yanked along by the hero as they're in heels and dress, as they're running from some danger. Women have an uncanny ability to get themselves into dangerous situations for which they are extricated by their men. If they do handle a gun occasionally, it's ever so gingerly to just sort of shoot and keep their feminism. Usually they just stand there helplessly while the hero fights off a platoon of attackers. This is what women are for in Rambo movies. Movies like Red Dawn, Invasion USA, and television series like America, I think, represent the crudest propaganda of the Reaganite cinema of the 1980s. They show the Soviets, assisted by the Nicaraguans and the Cubans and the Libyans, invading and attacking the United States and killing and massacring U.S. citizens. Again, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, you know, history is stood on its head. The Soviets have never invaded the U.S. I have to kind of remind my students of that once in a while. But the U.S. has invaded Soviet Russia, well, along with 14 other nations, 1919 to 1921. They moved in and took them over. But that isn't what you see in Red Dawn. In Red Dawn, The Soviets, they have a nuclear attack on Washington, D.C. They wipe out Washington, D.C. because they are having troubles with their crop. They have crop failures and they're having famines. So they decide to take it out on Washington, D.C. And they come down and they invade and take over the heartland of America. And they're rounding up people and they're massacring them. Also in Red Dawn, Cuba and Nicaragua have emerged as leading powers in the Western Hemisphere. And these Spanish-speaking soldiers are machine-gunning all these Americans. I mean, it's just horrible. But luckily, in a little town in Colorado, a group of high school students escape. And they break into a sporting goods store, and they get out all these rifles, and they go up into the hills, spend the rest of the movie wiping out these whole convoys of Russians. I mean, just wiping them out. I mean, you start feeling sorry for the Russians. They're just getting wiped out by these kids with the rifles who call themselves the Wolverines. In Invasion USA, that was even more fascinating. A secret expeditionary force lands in Miami. Can you imagine landing secretly in Miami on a bright moonlit night? Hundreds of Russians and Spanish-speaking, Spanish-looking guys, who we can assume are Cubans and Nicas, and Arab-looking fellas, who we can assume are PLOs and Libyans, maybe. And they're all actually quite a good little international force they had there. and they land about 20 yards from the Montembleu, you know, totally unimpeded, undetected. And I'm sitting there saying, who could do this fanning out, getting to trucks? They aren't drug smugglers. I mean, they couldn't And they fan out and they infiltrate up the coast and they start committing acts of terror which turn neighbor against neighbor and neighbors against the police and the police against the neighbors, and nobody knows what's going on. Nobody can understand how this is happening. Nobody can understand what the danger is, what is they're confronting. Nobody except Chuck Norris, who single-handedly rallies some troops and wipes them out and saves America. Well, the Russians have never invaded the United States. I tell my students the United States has invaded Russia, and they say, what? What? What movie was that? What? The Nicaraguans have never invaded the United States. While that film was being produced and made and distributed and viewed, the United States was invading Nicaragua for the ninth time in our history. Seven of those times before there ever was a Soviet Union. The Cubans have never invaded the United States, but the United States has invaded Cuba in 1961 and has encircled Cuba and has oppressed that economy and done everything it could to destabilize that country with embargo, with political oppositions, with acts of sabotage. The Libyans have never attacked the United States, but the U.S. has attacked and threatened and harassed Libya on several occasions. That's what the movies ought to be about. And Gaddafi's sin is not that he's a terrorist. Gaddafi's sin is that he took a country that had a social structure like Saudi Arabia, and in the Colonel's Rebellion of whatever year it was, 1965, thank you, what they did was they took over the land. They reclaimed and confiscated the oil. They confiscated the property of the rich. They kicked them out. They instituted changes. They set up a reclamations program. They've planted 40 million trees in Libya. They've put in a public education program for every man, woman, and child. Women can now go to school. Women can even go to military academy. Gaddafi's real sin is that he's distributed income, that the Libyans have the highest per capita income and standard of living in the Arab world. And Gaddafi's real sin is that he's an anti-imperialist. And so what they do is make movies showing Gaddafi-like Arab terrorists terrorizing and victimizing you to stir up in us hatred and fear of these people. Well, you can say, well, you know, that's the way it is with the masses. Luckily, I'm not affected by that stuff. Well, Jeffrey Schrank did a very interesting study in one of his books. He pointed out that 90% of all TV viewers think that we are not affected by advertisements. He also pointed out that the same 90% buys roughly 90% of the products that are advertised on television. And while we might think it is always other people being manipulated by these images and these sales appeals and these shows, the truth might be something else. Another investigator, Jerry Mander, in Mander's book, The Case Against TV, he argues that the media images are in a certain way irresistible, in the sense that our brains absorb them regardless of how we may consciously regard such images. So you may consciously be watching this thing and saying, isn't this ridiculous, isn't this something? But these images are going into your head. They're going into the other side, while this side of the brain is saying, isn't that awful? This side is absorbing it. Children, for instance, if you want to see how it works, look at children. You've got to carefully talk to a child and convince the kid that this isn't real life, that don't worry, that didn't happen. They really don't have an innate capacity to distinguish between real and unreal images. Only as they grow older, after repeated assurances from their elders, they begin to understand that the stories and the characters on the big screen or the little screen really don't exist in real life. In other words, their ability to reject media images as unreal has to be learned. It's a learned ability. Their innate predisposition is to accept those images as real. Now, Mander argues further. He says the problem doesn't stop there. Even as adults, when we consciously know that a particular movie, TV is fictional, we still, quote, believe it to some extent. That is, we accumulate these impressions, and these impressions lead to beliefs about the real world. Our unconscious mind does not distinguish between the images we got from real experience and the images we got from a secondary environment like movies and TV. The mind doesn't work that way. Listen to what the African-American writer Ellen Hawley has to say. I want to quote her at length because it's worth it. The way we are perceived by this society affects the most basic areas of our lives. When you apply for a job, the interviewer in personnel reacts to you not only in terms of who you are, but also in terms of who he thinks you are. There are countless images floating around in his head, and many of them are traceable to the media. You may sit in front of him as a neatly dressed, intelligent female who would do an efficient job, but if he's been fed one stereotype too many, he may look and see, not you, but Flip Wilson's Geraldine, goofing on the job, painting her fingernails, and calling up a boyfriend to chat on company time. If so, for all your qualifications, you're not the one who's going to get the job. Black teenage unemployment runs as high as 40% in some of the more deprived communities. I don't think it helps black teenagers get hired that the television box portrays them to the nation and to potential employers almost exclusively as vicious little hoods ready to rip off anything in sight, or as goof-offs and clowns. Again and again, I have seen black actors turned down for parts because they were told that they did not look the way a black person should or sound the way a black person should. What is this business of should? What kind of a box are we being put into? I have seen black writers told that the black characters they write about were not believable because they were too intelligent. Well, look, we're giving the people what they want, the argument goes. This is a popular culture. Let me make two arguments to that. One, the polls show otherwise. They show that, in fact, people are watching more television but enjoying it less. That substantially high percentages say they think it stinks. Most people at best say that TV is either not very interesting or mildly interesting. Only a small percentage think it's really terrific and they really find it great. It's called popular culture. In fact, most of it is done for sponsors, and most of these producers really go on the hunches they have, what they talk to their colleagues and their neighbors and all that sort of thing. And it's not popular culture. Popular is an adjective for the populace, meaning the people, something that comes from the people. This media culture doesn't come from the people. It's not a people's culture. If anything, the mass media have undermined, preempted popular culture. The folk arts are gone, folk crafts are in decline, community recreation, community forms of interaction. When people talk, often they talk about not their experiences, but about TV experiences and celebrity characters. The image environment is a highly fabricated, controlled one. It's dominated by multi-billion dollar multinational corporations. They are the ones who produce and fabricate and feed this culture to us. They not only have a preeminent influence over the quality of the food we eat, the air we breathe, the water we drink, but also now the forms of recreation that are available, and even the very images we put in our heads. It's argued that demand creates supply. We're giving the people what they want. If they didn't demand this, they wouldn't get it. The people want it, so we give it to them. But quite often, as you know, it's supply that creates demand. People watch what's on television because that's the only thing that's on television. They go to junk movies because that's what the movies are. Rambo 3 opened up in 2,175 movie theaters in America. That's supply right there.